This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Indiana University Northwest economist Micah Pollack joined other regional experts in Valparaiso to put up his report on the region's economic outlook going into 2019, and he shared the good economic news with us.
Well, for the first time in a long time, I'm pleased to say that it's actually very optimistic for a change. The latest values of the Indiana Coincident Economic Index we publish have been very good, and so far in 2018, Northwest Indiana has grown by about 2.7% at an annual rate, which is really good for the region. In 2017, we only grew at 0.4%, and if you go all the way back from 2012 to 2017, which covers much of the recovery from the Great Recession, we only grew at 1.3%. So in this last year, we're growing at roughly twice the rate we've been averaging over the last 5 years or so, which is pretty impressive.
In putting the data together, you and your colleagues come up with this this report. In this case, we're talking here with an economic outlook for locally as well as for the state and for the country. What factors or what indicators do you use in putting your report together that you've come up with this very optimistic outlook?
Sure. So we use a variety of different economic indicators, and the term coincident in the name Coincident Economic Index refers to a particular empirical technique designed to look for trends in data that maybe underlying the data that reflect the economy. And so some of the components of the index have grown tremendously in this last year. For example, Northwest Indiana retail sales are up to $509 million in September when they began the year at closer to about $490 million. So we have about $10 million or so extra retail sales. Northwest Indiana employment has risen slightly. Around the beginning of the year, we were looking at about 270,000, 274,000. Now we're up to about 280,000. Residential new building permits are way up this year and last as well. And so that's a good sign. And in particular, the steel industry is doing very well. Indiana steel production has risen from the beginning of the year from about 1.8 million metric tons to a little over 2 million metric tons.
Going through the data that you just mentioned here in the various categories, you mentioned about the fact that we see such things as improved building starts and the like. We see improved business overall in Northwest Indiana. Is that a surprise, or have you kind of seen things maybe creep up a little bit over the last few years, and then this latest data just kind of bears things out?
It is a little bit of a surprise. You know, since the Great Recession in Northwest Indiana, we've had these kind of ongoing trends where goods-producing jobs have been declining, and those are traditionally high-paying jobs, mm-hmm. and we see low-paying service sector jobs coming in to replace those jobs, and that's been going on since 2012. But in the last year or so, that's really changed, and in the end of 2017 into 2018, we're adding more goods-producing jobs and service-providing jobs, and at the same time, wages are going up in those existing service providing jobs by quite a bit. So we are seeing a pretty significant change from the previous trends.
Now, you mentioned that to have a good outlook to look forward to. Is that an outlook that would be relatively short term? That is maybe only to the end of 2018, or is that going to get this well into 2019?
Well, the forecast that we estimate, which is a 6-month forecast, will get us a little ways into 2019. I will say there's a lot of uncertainty, particularly a lot of the strong growth in steel depends a lot on what happens with tariffs going forward. And right now, the overall kind of net positive for Northwest Indiana from the tariffs, but that certainly could change depending on if demand for steel falls off as the price of steel rises so much, and if we don't have enough supply chain to handle all the additional production. But right now, it looks pretty optimistic, at least for the next 6 months or so going forward.
Now, you mentioned, Beth, that we've seen some growth in the business sector. What kind of impact are we likely to see with the opposite way, where we have companies like Sears having to close up its stores because it's filed for bankruptcy, and other companies that maybe are doing well, but they maybe in the near future may have to make some changes?
Yeah, so retail sales is something, and retail employment is something that, that's very big in Northwest Indiana. On the plus side, those jobs tend to be lower-paying jobs, and so if the region does lose those jobs, in some ways it's easier to absorb that loss than if we are losing higher-paying manufacturing jobs. Of course, we hate to lose any jobs, but if we are going to be losing some jobs, and every month we lose jobs and we just hope that we create more than we lose, I'd rather be losing those low-paying jobs than higher-paying jobs.
Maybe making the transition because of education and other reasons to go from, you say, from the lower paying jobs into the higher paying jobs, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have rising educational attainment in Northwest Indiana, and we're still below the state and the nation, but we are kind of closing that gap slowly.
Now, going out a little farther, how do things look from the basis and based on your information for the state of Indiana and looking nationally?
Again, there's a lot of uncertainty here. We have all sorts of issues, whether it's the stock market, the tariff, the election, that are going to come into play here shortly. And so it's hard to predict. If things continue the way they're going now, I think it's a pretty optimistic next year or so. But again, businesses don't like uncertainty. The stock market doesn't like uncertainty, and these things could change very quickly depending on if the Federal Reserve decides on a new interest rate policy, or if we have some kind of political change that happens here, or if, you know, the trade war continues to get worse.
So it looks like that maybe we're luckier here in Northwest Indiana. We have better indicators that show that things are improving here, and maybe not necessarily the case if you broaden the look, looking to the rest of the Hoosier State and even the country. So we're all
that's true. Although we are, you know, we tend to have slower growth in both the state and the nation. So while we are accelerating our growth, we still have some room to make up to catch up to both the state and the nation.
A Ball State University junior who is a native of Munster is part of a student team that is helping a non-for-profit over in the Muncie area, a healthcare service, with their marketing and human resources. And we're talking with Haley Collison of Munster to find out more about that, about her studies at Ball State University in Muncie, and how she got involved with this interesting project. And Haley, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, first tell us a little bit about what you're studying and how it fits in so well with this very interesting immersive learning course that you're taking right now.
Okay, so I'm actually a marketing and human resource management major, so it falls under both of my majors, which is really beneficial for me coming in the future. So I get to deal with or and help out with both projects and just get to know both aspects of what is going on within the Immersive Learning Project.
This fits in very nicely, of course, with what you're majoring in. I guess are you double majoring in human resource management and marketing, or are they two separate degrees?
I am double majoring in marketing and HR management, yeah,
okay.
But they are separate degrees as well.
Okay. How did you find out more about this immersive learning course? Was this something that you have to take, or was this an opportunity within the department that you could get involved with and in turn add on to your degree work, certainly, and also your experience that you're picking up?
It actually is just offered throughout the university to help out with real-life experiences, so I don't technically have to do it, but I was sitting in class one day, and the instructor who is overseeing everything, since it is a student-run organization, came in and talked a little bit about it, and I was so intrigued because I love to help out with people, so I'm indirectly helping with that to make their whole back system better and help out with that.
Mm-hmm. How did you get involved, I guess, with other students in this? This is not just a project that you do singly. It's a teamwork, isn't it?
Yes, it is. So our group is made up of many different majors, so then we can get different backgrounds and opinions on certain things that we're working on. So the instructor went around to different classes and majors and asked people if they would like to be a part of it. So I didn't know anybody going into the project originally, but now we all really work together nicely, and it's coming along really well.
Now we've kind of set the stage for what you are doing with your fellow students at Ball State on this project. Tell us more what you have learned, and more in general, I guess, about this organization, which is called Open Door Health Services. Where is it located? What do they really do?
So my group is currently, or what I've learned personally with my group, is that there's more on the onboarding aspect of a company and orientation. So my group is currently working on redoing theirs and helping out make theirs better for new employees coming in and just overall training within their company. And Open Door is a federally operated health service, and they provide health services for people with insurance and without insurance, which is really beneficial. They have multiple locations in Muncie and Anderson,
mm-hmm,
on bus routes, so it really helps people in low-income areas to get around to the place, get around to Open Doors. And Open Doors is like kind of like a one-stop shop. So they have dental, they have women health care, they have pediatrics, and they have a wide scope of everything, and it's really helpful.
Does Open Door Services, obviously they have more than one location, are they all over the city of Muncie pretty much? In what you're doing with your project here with the course that you're taking, do you get to travel around to different locations of the facilities?
We've actually just seen their one main one located in downtown Muncie, because that's where their offices are for their human resource specialist and their marketing and community outreach person resides. So we've mostly just seen that one, but they are located throughout Muncie.
When you get involved in a project like this where you're doing your work in human resource management, you're obviously working, I guess, with the staff that in turn will probably help screen, interview, and in turn place people that will eventually become just regular employees of an operation in general. How do you fit in what you're learning in with this particular organization, Open Door Health Services?
So we don't deal directly with the new employees just yet. We might get to that. We have to see what the spring semester brings about for our projects.
Mm-hmm.
But right now we are just doing the orientation process and to make that better, so how they can make it more interesting for the new employees coming in, and it's not just like a basic orientation. We want to make it fun and interactive for everybody involved.
We're talking with Haley Collison, who is a junior at Ball State University over in Muncie. She's a Munster native, and she's taking courses which basically get her, when she graduates, get her degrees in human resource management and marketing, and then you have a minor in criminal justice, too. How did you happen to choose this line of study, any of it for that matter, the human resource management, marketing, and of all things, criminal justice? Did you find things when you were going to high school in Munster that appealed to you, or just taking a look at the coursework when you enrolled at Ball State?
I really like to challenge myself with different aspects of learning and studying and just my overall, like, way of life. So I chose marketing and resource management just so I could have a wider range of experience and, like, expertise in different places. So if I'm open to many different opportunities when I graduate, so I'm just kind of keep my options open and see where life leads me. And the criminal justice, I just really like to help people. So if that takes me in a different route, I would be more than welcome to explore it.
Do you think there may be, since you're getting your basic degrees, I guess, in human resources management, marketing, do you think that maybe the criminal justice may open up an opportunity, say, if there's a chance to go work for some government in opportunities that will get you either with the police department or a jail or something like that? Would at least you know what it's all about?
Oh, yes, definitely. I would love to work for any of those. It would not bother me at all.
Well, now that you're a junior, tell us a little bit. Have some of your other coursework up to this point, up until this immersive learning course that you're now involved in, has it been seemingly pretty boring, or have there been some interesting things that you have taken in your freshman and sophomore and some of your other junior coursework to get you up to this point at Ball State?
I wouldn't necessarily say my classes were boring, but
they're probably just some routine classes that every college student has to take, and we all go through that.
Oh yeah, definitely.
It's general studies courses tend to be really dry, and maybe to some be boring here too. And then you get into your major or your minor courses, and they pique your interest more, I imagine.
Oh, definitely. I did take a lot of my core classes early on, but I came into college with 13 credits, so I've been taking a lot of my major classes from the beginning. So I've been very fortunate with that opportunity to happen for me to be able to come in with a lot of credits. So it took out a lot of my core classes that I had to take here.
Now that you're getting close, I suppose, to your senior year now, and you have another year of courses, what do you have to look forward to that you're going to be able to do in your major and your minors to get you closer to your diploma?
One thing I'm really looking forward to is a lot of my classes coming in the spring semester and even next year are all, like, project-based.
Mm-hmm.
So they're very real-world experience-like, and I get to work with groups of people within my major, so it'll really help me prepare for when I'm in my actual career with working with people who have the same major as me and working on the same project. So it really brings together that teamwork and that overall morale within a company.
So you think this immersive learning course that you're taking right now, getting yourself and the other students involved with working with Open Door Health Services, is really a good way to get yourself into future courses where you're going to be doing sort of the same sort of idea, that you're going to be working with teams and working toward project ends and things like that?
Exactly. I'm a huge people person, so this is right up my alley with what I want to do.
Well, barring any problems that come along the way here, when do you hope to be able to get your diploma?
I am hoping to graduate in May of 2020.
And once you get your degree, any prospects out that you've talked to or things that have interested you out there? Or you're not quite at that point yet that you're not looking for a job, but you know that you will eventually.
Yes, I'm currently looking for internships in either marketing and HR management right now. And any, like, if anything in the government comes about towards me, I would be more than open to looking at that. But yeah, right now I'm just looking for internships and seeing where that takes me.
We've been talking with Haley Collison. She's a Munster native. She's a junior now at Ball State University in Muncie, and she's part of a student team that is working with a non-for-profit healthcare organization in Delaware County. That's in Muncie, working with marketing and human resources. And Haley, thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about what you've been doing up to this point and this immersive learning course that you're very much involved in. And hope that things go well.
Thank you so much for having me. This is a pleasure.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. It's time once again for another edition of Green Fleet Radio, and here's your host, Carl Lissick.
Well, thank you for the introduction, and welcome to Green Fleet Radio. Today, our guest is Mr. Gus Olympidis. He's the president and CEO of Family Express. Gus, welcome to the show.
It's good to be here.
Well, I think most of our listeners know Family Express, but for those who may not, tell us, what is Family Express and what do you do?
Well, I would like to think that most of the listeners have an idea about Family Express, but basically we're a local chain of convenience stores born and raised in Northwest Indiana that is built in the context of people that have a genetic predisposition to build relationships. So, which is nice.
Mm-hmm. It is nice. So we know Family Express was an early adopter of ethanol, and I know that you were involved with the Hoosier Homegrown Fuel Blender Pump Program to further your commitment. Tell us a bit about your decision to add ethanol to your fuel offerings, and why did you make that decision?
Yeah, Carl, this is going back a few years, yes. Maybe 13 or 14 mm-hmm. years. There was a time in my life where I looked at the state of our energy reality in our country, and I felt compelled to be a part of the solution. These were the early stages of investing in biofuels in Indiana for the simple reason that we can produce biofuels, mm-hmm. biofuels in Indiana, and we have the blessing of corn and water, and we are geographically apropos mm-hmm. for developing energy that is renewable. But most importantly, during those years, most of us have forgotten that our country was investing close to between $500 and $750 billion a year to buy energy mm-hmm. Abroad. It's been said that this was the vastest migration of wealth in the history of mankind. It was clearly unsustainable. And since then, our nation has sort of gotten its act together. And today, I don't believe it's an accident that we're celebrating a robust economy. At the same time, we're celebrating the ability of our nation not just to meet its needs, but also to export energy. Now, instrumental in this endeavor was a prevailing philosophy that I promoted back then that is still relevant today, that all clean energy, for as long as it is domestic, is the answer to the question, the solution to the problem. Mm-hmm. And no particular hyper-affection with any particular type of energy at the expense of other domestic clean sources of energy makes sense in terms of a strategic realignment of our nation to self-sufficiency.
I know that you had family members that were involved in the military. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, one of our sons, some 12 years ago, followed the calling of his country and lived up to his obligation to serve. He served in Mosul, Iraq, at the same time that we are beginning to sort of conscious today what has happened since with ISIS actually having control of this city until recently. But back then, a bunch of brave men and some women from Northwest Indiana presided over two elections for the people of Iraq. I mean, think of the irony of American lives being sacrificed to give people that are of different persuasion and cultural foundation the gift of democracy, something that we take for granted.
So we understand ethanol makes a good environmental sense, but it also makes good economic sense. Can you share a bit of information about the cost savings associated with ethanol and how it helps Indiana farmers?
Well, any kind of domestic energy has the economic multiplier of local. Anytime you export capital for energy, you lose the multiplier at the very least. So we're talking about domestic jobs. We're talking about a cleaner environment. But equally as importantly, you and I have had the conversation about the hidden cost of traditional energy being replaced by ethanol because of the inherent $1.50 to $2.50 per gallon cost for defense to facilitate its existence. So not only ethanol makes economic sense when you look at it just by itself, but when you think of it in the context of energy independence and the minimizing of the necessity for us to support armies, navies, and air forces all over planet Earth to keep sea lanes open, it is hard to argue about the wisdom of biofuels. It's just I think if for no other reason, take economics out of it, and the economic argument is very compelling. As patriots, we should be excited about buying energy from people that don't want to behead us.
Yeah, absolutely. So I know ethanol isn't the only sustainability effort that Family Express is making. You've chosen to embrace energy efficiency in all of your convenience stores and stations as well. So tell our listeners a little bit about that.
Yeah, there's a little difference in our investment in energy efficiency through a variety of means, lighting, energy-efficient furnaces, energy management systems, and what have you, versus the early contribution to the solution through biofuels. Today, diverting inefficient methods of delivering services that require energy to efficient makes economic sense to a great extent. That is a simple mathematical equation. I think good organizations that have a forward-thinking mindset and are planning to be around for a while make an investment in efficient devices because it makes economic sense. The early investment in E85 and ethanol was a decision of conscience. In fact, those early days, it was difficult to organize an economic argument for it. It just it's something that needed to be done because unless you provided the retail infrastructure for it, E85 would never get off the ground. Right. And it was a chicken and egg thing. And at some point, somebody had to just step up to the plate and do the right thing and hold your breath and not turn white for a few years. And today, it has evolved into also a good, a sound economic decision. But early on, it was the motivation was patriotism. More than economic prudence.
Sure. Well, and you've continued that on for so many years, and you're the leader in our state and one of our leaders in this entire country with your commitment. So how can our listeners learn more about Family Express and your sustainability efforts?
Well, most importantly, what can the listeners do that would be of direct benefit to them? First and foremost, you may be driving a flex fuel vehicle and not even know it.
Mm-hmm.
Flex fuel is more economic. You're going to hear some chatter about your gasoline mileage declining. It will decline modestly, but it's so much less expensive than regular fuel that at the end of the day, it makes economic sense and it helps the environment. Unlike some of the, again, the chatter, using fuel that has been produced by consuming corn is not going to affect food supply.
Sure.
Don't expect to see any people starving because you bought ethanol. Only a modest part of the corn that is produced, somewhere around 20%, goes to ethanol, and 80% of the corn that is used is returned back to, in various forms, from animal feed to you name it. Consequently, the extraction of the fuel makes terrific sense for the environment, for our pocketbook and our economy. So you may be driving a vehicle that could use E85. If you're not driving a vehicle that is flex fuel, when you go to the pump, always choose unleaded 88 because it has a slightly higher content of ethanol. Instead of 10%, it's 15% ethanol. So, again, that 5% doesn't sound like much, but with a multiplier of billions and billions of gallons, kind of think of it every time you use it in a subliminal way, in your mind and in your heart, you're waving an American flag.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, Gus, we're out of time, and that will do it for today's edition of Green Fleet Radio. Thank you again to Gus Olympidis, President and CEO of Family Express. Continued success to you. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy.
Green Fleet Radio is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities, and you can hear Green Fleet Radio on Wednesdays here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. And the podcasts of Green Fleet Radio are always on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, and you can find them on the smartphone on the NPR One app. Just search for WLPR. This is Regionally Speaking. Got some news from Franciscan Health about a new professional services agreement that involves not only Northwestern Memorial Hospital, but hospitals here in Northwest Indiana as well. And for this, we are turning to the president and CEO of Franciscan Health, Crown Point, Dr. Daniel McCormick. Dr. McCormick, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I'll let you make the big announcement here, and it's a very important announcement that involves patients here in Northwest Indiana and some great facilities. Tell us about it.
Well, yes, it's a very impactful announcement. Traditionally, we've cared for patients in Northwest Indiana who have suffered stroke symptoms through our accredited stroke centers at our facilities. Recently, medical literature has shown that we can expand the treatment of patients with stroke and improve their outcomes remarkably up to 24 hours of the onset of symptoms. Those studies came out in the New England Journal of Medicine at the beginning of 2018. Since that time, Northwestern has been taking care of those patients within the 24-hour period. Prior to that, it had really been cut off at about 6 hours. So patients who would suffer a stroke and would not be able to seek care until 6 hours after the onset of symptoms would essentially be relegated to no treatment or modified treatment, would portend a worse prognosis with regards to recovery. As we expand the treatment of symptoms, as we expand the treatment window, then what the studies showed is that if you are able to show that there is significant brain tissue that has not suffered irreversible damage, that you can show significant improvement in their recovery. And so with Northwestern's assistance and our collaboration, we are able now to provide care for patients up to 24 hours after the onset of symptoms. And we will be doing that through a telestroke program. The program is set to start at the beginning of 2019 and really will encompass tell the stroke monitors in our emergency rooms in Hammond, Munster, Dyer, and Crown Point.
Tell us a little more about the telestroke program. We've heard about this in other facilities, in particular with the Northwestern Memorial Hospital System. How is that going to work well here in Northwest Indiana?
Well, the monitors will be in place in all of the emergency rooms, and we'll have protocols in place so when a patient arrives through any of our EMS systems into our emergency rooms, the telestroke monitor would be brought into the patient's room, and within 10 minutes we would receive consultation from Northwestern Department of Neurology. Those specialists are trained specifically in stroke and would be readily available to view not only the patient and ask the patient questions and run through physical exam, speak with the physician, but also review all of the radiology that's involved with the diagnosis and treatment of stroke.
When you talk about being able to set up the telestroke services within the facilities in Crown Point and Dyer and Hammond and Munster, you have a lot of possibilities, I guess, for making sure that patients get the treatment that they need almost, not quite immediately, but pretty close to it, because we know that minutes count when it comes to somebody who's suffering from a stroke.
Correct, and that's probably the most significant impact of the program. Time is of the essence in the patient who suffers a stroke. And with being able to expand the window of treatment up to 24 hours, we should be able to impact the outcomes of patients in Northwest Indiana quite significantly. And, I think the one thing we have to understand, if we don't have the equipment on hand to provide care, we can immediately transfer the patient to Northwestern. With our agreement, we have an understanding that they would already meet the neurologist through the telestroke platform, and they would see them at the receiving end at Northwestern, and that would be facilitated amongst our two facilities in a seamless manner. And so we would get rid of a lot of the stumbling blocks of transferring a patient in an expeditious manner.
Now, if the routine is going through as it should with the changeover for the telestroke program, if need be having to take somebody to Northwestern Memorial Hospital, how long on average would it take to get a patient from Northwest Indiana right into downtown Chicago?
Well, that's a very good question. A lot of that would depend on the severity of the symptoms and the interventions planned on their end. So the modes of transportation are obviously by land or by air.
Right.
And you could, and so it would depend on which mode that it would take. Obviously, if it were by land, it would take longer depending on the time and the weather. And also, the air transport can be less than a half hour to get to that facility. It also will depend on the weather.
Well, it still sounds like, though, that you can get a patient quickly to a facility if need be. If you can't take care of them here in Northwest Indiana, you can get them into the main hospital in Chicago and get the treatment continuing on right away.
Right, and that's the critical piece. We wanted to take out a lot of the barriers to getting a patient to the appropriate location for the treatment that they need.
Okay. Tell us how long it's taken, I guess, to get all these arrangements made. This is not something that you can do overnight, I would imagine.
That is very true. We have been speaking with Northwestern for the greater part of a year at this time, but there are a lot of pieces you could imagine that we have to get in place to have a program of this, this impactful of a program implemented. We here in Crown Point will be initiating the program and making sure that we have the systems in place, and then we'll roll it out after to Hammond, Munster, Dyer.
Well, it sounds like it's a great program that's gotten underway with the start of the program here involving Franciscan Health and Northwestern Memorial Hospital partnering on some very important neurological services that will help everybody in Northwest Indiana, certainly in particular those suffering from strokes, to get the help they need right away. And Dr. McCormick, thank you very much for talking about it, and the best of luck, and hope this new arrangement works well and will help as many people as possible.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking with Dr. Daniel McCormick. He's the president and CEO of Franciscan Health Crown Point. Franciscan Health is now partnering with Northwestern Memorial Hospital and partnering on neurological services that include a very interesting and innovative telestroke program to help patients maybe suffering from strokes. Most expected Indiana's U.S. Senate race to be a nail-biter, and many expected Tuesday night to be a long one for Democratic incumbent Senator Joe Donnelly and his Republican challenger Mike Braun. But as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith tells us, neither prediction came true, as Braun coasted to an easy and early victory.
Joe Donnelly did everything he could in the campaign to position himself in the center of the political road, and in the end, he got run over. Yet in his brief concession speech, Donnelly still struck a tone of unity.
We need to make sure we work to bring our country together rather than to divide it, to make sure every American has a chance.
Senator-elect Mike Braun says he'll go to Washington to prove that Indiana's way of thinking will work for the rest of the nation.
We've got 2 years to show that as conservatives, we can make things work. We need to get our president reelected.
Donnelly's loss leaves Democrats without a single statewide elected official. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
Meanwhile, Republican incumbent Connie Lawson will remain Indiana's Secretary of State for another 4 years. And Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton tells us that Republicans have held the seat for more than two decades.
In a wide margin, Connie Lawson secured another term as Indiana Secretary of State. Lawson says she will focus on election security leading up to the presidential election.
Security recommendations and hacksters change their methods all the time. We did a great job today, and we'll continue to work on that.
During the race, Democrat Jim Harper criticized Lawson for not pushing for redistricting reform and same-day voter registration as Secretary of State. Harper says while he's disappointed, he's excited to see a high voter turnout.
While I'm obviously wish that some of those votes had gone a different direction, it is a good sign for our democracy that so many people participated in this process.
Libertarian Mark Rutherford captured about 3% of the vote, meaning the Libertarian Party retains automatic ballot access for the next 4 years. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
Corporations that give political contributions not only are likely to get a federal contract out of those contributions, but the contracts may be very, very advantageous to the firm. Now, that is according to a new study put out by Ball State University. And our next guest here on the program is going to tell us more about that. Reza Houston is a Ball State University finance professor, and he has worked with some researchers in a couple other universities around the country on what is being called a sweetheart index. And Reza Houston is with us today. Thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Chris.
Tell us a little bit about what I guess the term sweetheart index is all about, and how did you and your colleagues from University of Colorado, Colorado Springs, and Florida Atlantic University had to come up with?
The sweetheart index really refers to this idea of a sweetheart contract, where the contract terms are really very lucrative to the firm that receives the contract. So my colleagues and I actually had this idea to create a sweetheart index to measure the quality of government contracts being received by government contractors. And we wanted to look at who actually receives these sweetheart contracts, these contracts that are, well, more lucrative.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we did was we looked at the relationship between contributions made by firm-affiliated PACs to candidates for federal office and the quality of future contracts that those firms receive. And what we find is this really positive relationship between the PAC contributions made by these firm-affiliated PACs and the quality of the sweetheart index, or the quality of the contracts that's being received.
Mm-hmm.
And the sweetheart index is really made up of four different characteristics. It ranges from 0 to 4, depending on which of these characteristics the individual contract exhibits. So whether it's a no-bid contract, whether it's a cost-plus versus fixed-fee contract, whether it's a long-term contract, and whether or not there's certain cost or pricing data required at the time of contract signing. So certain contracts exhibit all of these characteristics, whereas certain contracts exhibit none of them. So we actually identify, a couple of fairly significant relationships. Our overall result is that, yes, there is a positive relationship between PAC contributions and sweetheart index, but we also find that each of these individual characteristics of the sweetheart index, in particular, no-bid contracts or sole-source contracts, and cost-plus contracts, we find a very positive relationship between PAC contributions of firms to candidates for public office and the likelihood that the contracts that they're receiving are no-bid and cost-plus. And obviously, there's some potential endogeneity here, since a lot of these firms that are receiving these large government contracts are firms that operate in industries like the aviation industry or some other industry that's very tightly intertwined with the federal government, and so therefore they're very likely making large PAC contributions. And so we actually had to run a number of endogeneity tests to control for this this relationship. And so we did a couple of different things. The first thing we did was look at what happens when a firm increases its PAC contributions to federal government employees. And what we found was that firms that increase their PAC contributions actually see an increase in the quality of the sweetheart, or in the sweetheart index of their government contracts over the next year or 2 years or even 3 years, although it diminishes after that. Next, we looked at what happens when a firm makes a contribution to a candidate for public office who then becomes the chair of a very powerful committee in the Senate or the House. So, for example, let's say, well, name a company that is a government contractor. Maybe I shouldn't. But let's say a company makes a contribution to a current senator who then, after the election, becomes the new chair of the Appropriations Committee.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what we're finding is that those firms that make those contributions and then have the candidates that they've contributed to become the chair of a very powerful committee, like the Appropriations Committee or the House, the Ways and Means Committee, those firms see the most significant increase in their sweetheart index of their various contracts. And then finally, what we did was we looked at the results of close elections and how firms that made contributions to candidates who were not quite who we weren't sure were going to win their re-election bid or any election bid, what happened as a result of those PAC contributions. And so it's really what we have there is an exogenous shock where after the election, that candidate wins office, and we can look at, well, really what happens with a free hand, so to speak. And what we're finding in that test is that firms that make campaign contributions to candidates who win very close elections, they actually also see a significant increase in their quality of the contracts that they receive in the future.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned at the start of our conversation here that you and your colleagues in Colorado and in Florida had a chance to look over a number of contracts by various companies across the country, mainly dealing, as you say, in federal contracts. And you referred to, like, the aviation industry. Did you also have a chance to look at some information from, like, shipbuilding companies that might in turn be beneficial if they get the right kind of help on Capitol Hill that gets to contracts with the Navy for building ships or airplanes or something like that, or either any other types of procurement contractors like that?
Oh, absolutely. So what we have is a database of more or less all large government contracts provided by it's actually part of the federal procurement data system.
Mm-hmm.
And we matched contracts in that file to, firms that are publicly traded in the United States. And so we have this massive database of several million government contracts. Of course, the ones that actually exhibit these four variables that we can use to calculate the sweetheart index are the larger ones, contracts in excess of about 750,000. But these contracts are given out to firms in a variety of industries. It's not just aviation. It's not just shipbuilding. It could be pharmaceuticals even.
All right. Yeah.
So we can look at contracts in just about given out by just about every agency in the government.
Yeah, for example, you're talking about pharmaceuticals. You're talking about companies that might possibly be wanting to get contracts with HHS or the Veterans Administration, you know, especially for VA hospitals and clinics and things like that, and get yourself involved in that and in turn make some money and in turn some influence, I'm sure, at those particular areas. When you take a look at all this information together and the contracts, the importance of these people that have influence on the contracts, whether it's awarding them or, as you say, being members of appropriations committees and the like here, and how this all links together with political action campaigns that are out there, the PACs. And you talk about this political connectedness that seems to branch out even beyond making some kind of influence as a lobbyist. And like it goes into, I guess, even in hiring as well, too, does it not?
Oh, absolutely. Certainly it does. We actually, one of our variables in one of our later tests, and it's something I've used in some other papers, is a variable that indicates whether or not the firm has hired an individual who is a former politician or regulator to their board or management team. And so what we find is, in some cases, a positive relationship between the prior experience of these individuals or the hiring of these individuals and the quality of a firm's government contracts, although that really wasn't the focus of our paper.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that as we approach the midterm elections, and of course now with all of the atmosphere being as acrimonious as it is on Capitol Hill and in Washington, D.C., that the data that you all have come up with in putting this the sweetheart deal piece together, so to speak, is even more important than maybe ever before?
Absolutely. I mean, I think we're really just beginning to scratch the surface. And now that, well, given the current nature of politics, I think our work is probably going to be a little more important than it has been for the last several years.
We've been talking with Ball State University finance professor Reza Houston, who, along with colleagues working in research at the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs and at Florida Atlantic University, which is in northern Florida, have worked together and put out what they're referring to as a sweetheart index. And by the way, if you'd like to find out more about this index, it's going to be published in an upcoming issue of a report which is called the Financial Review. It's a publication put out by the Eastern Finance Association, and I'm sure that if this gets enough airplay, so to speak, and reading in the print media, that I'm sure that they'll either have to put more issues out or they're going to have to make sure that it's available on their website, too, I would imagine. We'll see what happens to come out of this, I suppose. And thank you very much, Reza, for being with us to talk about this. And thanks for you and your colleagues in Colorado and Florida working on this research to find out more about the link between contracts that are offered by federal governments and how political contributions play a very big role in this in one way or the other, maybe more behind the scenes, but it sometimes in particular this time of year is more important. Thank you very much for spending time to talk with us about this.
Thanks again, Chris.
Lakeshore Public Radio's furry friend Ollie joins us in the studio now to answer your pet's questions on Ask Ollie. The pet questions are voiced by woman-human Victoria Voller, and Ollie's responses are voiced by man-human Tom Maloney. Ask Ollie is supported by the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana.
Hi, Tom. I got a letter here from Diana Johnson in Union Township that is really awful. It's about a routine dental cleaning for her dog that turned into a full-blown nightmare. I'll read it to you. Dear Ollie, how does a routine dental cleaning turn into a nightmare? I'll tell you how. Because it happened to me and my little rescue dog, whose name is Trouble. Little did this little black and white Shih Tzu know on the morning of his scheduled dental procedure at Vail Park Animal Clinic in Valparaiso that he would be blinded in one eye. The routine cleaning, which is what every pet parent should do, resulted in teeth extraction and was turned into a horror for Trouble and me when Dr. Jerry Rodenbarger accidentally ruptured his eyeball with a dental instrument during the procedure. The immediate result was damage in both eyes and a blinding in one. After the procedure, Trouble was misdiagnosed by Vail Park veterinary staff as having glaucoma, and for 3 days they treated him for that while infection was building in both eyes. Well, I'm certainly not a professional, but even I know that glaucoma is a disease of the optic nerve and is not caused by damage to the eyeball and most certainly shouldn't appear just after a routine dental procedure. 7-year-old Trouble was failing fast, so I drove him to the Purdue University Veterinary School in West Lafayette, where his eye was removed and the eye socket sutured shut. The veterinarian there gave a diagnosis of traumatic ocular injury inflicted by Dr. Rodenbarger. Post-surgery, my little dog wouldn't eat on his own, was racked with infection, and couldn't play or sleep. I personally was on call with him all day and night trying to hand feed him, fighting the infection and getting him strong so he could adjust to having only one eye. It has taken 3 long months for trouble to recuperate from this eye injury and blindness, secondary infections, and dehydration. How can I bring closure to this awful, awful experience? Signed, Diana Johnson from Union Township.
Dear Diana, I'm happy to hear that trouble is doing much better. Just reading your letter made my teeth hurt, my eyes water. That's empathy for you. And that may be all I can offer today. There are current limitations of any remedy through the legal system unless your dog had market value, like a show dog or a service dog for the handicapped. I'm sure you know that veterinarians in practice have insurance to cover the medical costs that you have incurred as a result of their error. However, the pain and suffering both you and Trouble experienced may not be recognized as you hoped, according to the Indiana legal system. Rebecca Huss, Associate Dean for Academic Affairs, Professor of Law, and Phyllis and Richard Duesenberg Chair in Law at Valparaiso University, said that the Animal Legal Defense Fund is trying to change all of that by working to categorize pets as part of the family and not just property or livestock. You can bring personal closure to this horrific experience by continually working to give companion pets value, recognition of their importance in the family and their purpose in community. Fighting for animal rights and accountability through our legal system will give Trouble's experience meaning far beyond Northwest Indiana and perhaps pave the way for animals to really count. Signed, your friend in fur, Ollie.
And if you have a question for your friend and for Ollie, you can email it to Ollie at LakeshorePublicMedia, one long word, .org. That's Ollie at LakeshorePublicMedia.org. Ask Ollie is supported by the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. Tomorrow is Thursday, which we have Reporters Roundtable Thursday. We'll find out from Dan Carton of the Times of Northwest Indiana, and Carol Carlson from the Post Tribune about the stories posted online and in print, a lot of them having to do with the election.